Now on to the reason we are here. Judge London, he has an amazing career that starts with character building experiences, anything from being a gardener to a taxi driver to his current role as a Superior Court judge here in Orange County. He attended high school locally and is a graduate from Garden Grove High School. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree with high honors in English from Cal State Fullerton and his JD cum laude from Brigham Young University. Judge London and his wife Donna live in Lake Forest and are parents of 6 adult children. In his spare time, he enjoys bicycling, kayaking, hiking, and spending time with his family. And we'll turn the time over to Judge London to present his topic.
That's old. My wife cracked up at the bicycling and kayaking. It was before I ruined my back and some other things. Well, during World War II, in the European countryside, there were a lot of crossroads that didn't have road signs. So the U.S. Army posted soldiers at those intersections so they could direct the troops in the right direction. Well, during the Battle of the Bulge, the German SS launched Operation Griffin. And the objective of Operation Griffin was to ruin the logistics of the American supplies. So they took American uniforms from the POWs, put spies inside them that spoke fluent American, and sent them behind American lines with two objectives. One, to change all the road signs so they would send people in the wrong direction. And two, they would plant the traffic directors and send Americans in the wrong direction. So once the Americans figured this out, they needed ways to determine immediately and quickly whether the person they were dealing with was an American or a German spy. So the first approach was to ask them trivial questions about America, especially American sports. That worked out pretty good until they had General Bruce Clark, who said that the Chicago Cubs were part of the American League. He immediately found himself surrounded by rifles at gunpoint, and they almost shot him. They asked Omar Bradley questions about sports trivia, and he couldn't come up with the answers. Luckily, everybody in the world knew what Bradley looked like, so they just teased him and let him go. The second approach the Army used, they started issuing new identification papers for the people directing traffic, and so they purposely misspelled the word identification, knowing that the precise Germans would never misspell a word on the documents. So if the documents were spelled correctly, they knew they were forged and they're dealing with a German spy. My favorite approach is they would ask the person to sing all the verses of the national anthem. If they sang all the verses of the national anthem, they immediately arrested them as a German spy because no American knows our national anthem, but a trained German spy would. I've been concerned over the years that our children are not learning about the inspirational founding of this country. Two-thirds of American citizens cannot pass the U.S. citizenship test for foreign immigrants. Most Americans cannot name one thing that Ben Franklin is famous for. Most Americans cannot describe what the rule of law means. Most Americans cannot name a country the U.S. fought in World War II. So most Americans, especially young people, are uninformed about American history and current events. Their knowledge and opinions come primarily from social media. We are losing our American heritage. President Thomas Jefferson proclaimed, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be." He added, "It is the responsibility of every American to be informed." So let me fill in our knowledge gap this morning with 9 lesser-known stories from the founding fathers and mothers. Story number 1. Most people are unaware that George Washington was a brilliant spy master. He knew the value of information and misinformation. In secret communications, he was identified as Agent 711. So he supervised several spy networks throughout the colony. For security reasons, he broke those spy networks into individual independent cells. The identities of the agents was so secret that Washington himself didn't know who most of his spies were. They used a variety of techniques, some of which Washington pioneered. They used the famous invisible ink. They used masked letters. What would happen is you'd have a template with part of it cut out and you'd put it over the full letter, and that would show the actual coded message. And they would send the templated mask independently of the original letter. Washington spies used ciphers and coded letters. The one that's unbreakable today is you just list two columns of numbers. One is a page number and one is a word number for a book. And if they don't have the book, they cannot figure out that code. So you tell the person you're using the same book, the same publication, and it tells you page number and word number. Another spy technique was hidden messages. You know, they used those quills. They were able to wrap up messages and shove it up in a little quill. And everybody had writing quills so they could pass on the messages that way. The most unique aspect of Washington's spy network was his reliance on women. So the British officers were male chauvinists, and they were clueless that their housemaids and the pub waitresses could comprehend and listen to them talking about military strategies. So the barmaids would write the coded messages on hard-boiled eggs, which was a popular snack. And so when the spies came in, they would give them the hard-boiled egg with the invisible message on it. And no one would question her passing off eggs to a customer or carrying eggs around. My favorite one was the housemaids used the spy technique that they invented called the clothesline code. So in the Navy, you know, the Navy puts up flags with coded messages to other ships. Well, the housemaids would put up the laundry, hanging the laundry to dry in such a way that there was coded messages for the agents. And the British had no clue that their housemaid was a spy and broadcasting the coded messages when they were hanging up the laundry. One of George Washington's most important spies was Emily Geiger. She was a demure and petite woman, so she was able to successfully go behind enemy lines and carry vital messages. Once she was stopped and was questioned by British troops, while they were distracted, she chewed and swallowed the message. They didn't find anything on her, let her go. Luckily, she had the message memorized, so it didn't matter whether she'd eaten it or not. Well, in the fall of 1776, at the beginning of the war, one of Washington's favorite spies was captured by the British. He was 21-year-old Nathan Hale. And as he was hanged, Nathan declared the immortal words, "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country." Washington was enraged at the hanging, and the British paid the price several years later when the Benedict Arnold scandal was uncovered. They arrested Major Adjutant General John Andre, the head of British intelligence. The British had an informal agreement with the Americans that no officer would be hanged for doing their duty. So the British pleaded with Washington. Washington's aides pleaded with him not to hang John Andre, but he said, "Remember Nathan Hale," and ordered him hung. Washington was not only aware of the importance of intelligence, but also misinformation. Winston Churchill said that during war, truth is so precious, it must be surrounded by bodyguards of lies. So Washington knew this principle very well, so he would have his spy networks exaggerate the size and strength of the Continental Army when they were talking to British sympathizers. He also would put false messages to his troops in the regular mail, knowing that the British were reading the mail. And so one example took place before the decisive Battle of Yorktown. Washington wrote a letter to the French admiral of the large Caribbean fleet, asking him to move the fleet to New York Harbor to force General Clinton, the overall commander of the British forces, to hunker down in New York. The French admiral wrote back and said, "General Clinton's going nowhere. It would be better if we use the fleet to barricade Chesapeake Bay. That way we could cut off Cornwallis from reinforcements and resupply." So Washington agreed, but he sent out messages to his troops through the regular mail that the French fleet was coming up to New York City to barricade the English. So General Clinton hunkered down, and then with General Cornwallis was cut off from reinforcements and resupply, and his retreat was cut off by the French fleet, and so he was forced to surrender. So after the war, one British commander lamented, "Washington did not outfight the British, he outspied us." Story number two. Few people know that Ben Franklin almost killed himself twice, experimenting through electricity, which he called electrical fire. When he retired as a wealthy man from the printing business at age 42, he devoted most of his time to groundbreaking experiments with electricity. This made him internationally famous. In 1749, he invented the lightning rod, which is used today. He saved thousands of buildings and thousands of lives. In 1752, he did his famous kite experiment. As everyone knows, he put a lightning rod on the kite, went out in a storm when it's raining, had a key on the kite. When the lightning bolt hit the lightning rod, it came down the wet string. He grabbed the key and it shocked him. Well, most scientists do not believe he could have survived that incident. And so some scientists believe that the man who said honesty is the best policy lied and made up the whole story. Other scientists think the string was dry, and other scientists think that he caused a static discharge from the ions in the air, and so it was just a static shock that went down and not the full bolt of the lightning rod. So he almost killed himself with that experiment. And so in 1750, he told people that he could kill and cook a turkey with electricity. So he scheduled a public demonstration, a big crowd gathered. He had two giant primitive batteries that would do like a 3 or 4 foot static spark between the two of them. He held up the turkey, all of a sudden there's a flash, everyone was blinded. The turkey was flying around, gobbling all over the place, and they looked up and Ben Franklin was missing. They looked behind the table and there he was on the floor, unconscious. When he finally gained consciousness, he complained of chest pains and numbness, which lasted until the next day. Once again, it was a miracle he didn't kill himself, but he almost proved that you could kill and cook a person with electricity. Story number three, the foreign fighters, and you can look at some of this in the supplement, but Americans were not alone in their fight for independence. Other countries helped. Few people are aware that 6 foreign military commanders were American war heroes. 3 of those were given the honor of honorary American citizen. And there have only been 8 honorary American citizens in our history. 3 of those were foreign fighters in the American Revolution. Many of these foreign commanders were recruited by Ben Franklin when he was in Europe. The contribution of these fighters cannot be overstated. Marquis de Lafayette brought 6,000 French troops with him. German Baron von Steuben reorganized the full army in Valley Forge and wrote the army training manual. Polish Casimir Pulaski became the father of the American cavalry. Lithuanian Tadeusz Kościuszko was a brilliant combat engineer. Spanish Count Bernardo de Galvez led the fight along the Gulf Coast. And then there's German Baron von Kolb. So how many of you have heard of Count Galvez? So he was a Spanish governor of Louisiana. He helped make sure the Americans could take medicine and ammunition up and down the Mississippi. And in 1779, Spain entered the war. Did you know that Spain fought in the American Revolution? So Galvez quickly raised an army of Spaniards, Creoles, free blacks, Native Americans, and a few whites, and he captured the British forts along the lower Mississippi. He then marched and captured Pensacola and West Florida. By doing so, he tied up the British in the Gulf, and the city of Galveston is named after Galvez, and in 2014, he became the last honorary American citizen. Well, there's Baron Johann von Kolb. He was a Bavarian but fought in the French army. He came over with Lafayette, but the Americans passed over him for an officer's position, so he decided to go back to Europe. Before he went back to Europe, they caught him, made him a major general, and put him in command of some troops in Valley Forge. In 1780, they put him over the Southern Theater in command of 1,200 troops from Maryland and Delaware. While serving under General Gates at Camden, South Carolina, British Cornwallis made a huge frontal assault at the Continental Lines. The Americans outnumbered the British, But within 2 hours, or within 1 hour, there were 2,000 American casualties. General Gates fled. His army retreated. When he got that night, he grabbed another horse and fled 60 miles to Charlotte, North Carolina. He was almost tried as a traitor, General Gates. But while he was retreating, General Von Kalb and his men stood their ground. They even went on a counterattack. Finally, during battle, General Kalb was slashed with a saber, and then his horse was shot out from under him. Then while he was trying to get up, he was shot 3 times and bayoneted 8 times. He miraculously survived those injuries and was taken prisoner. A few days later, he died, and his final words were, "I die the death I always prayed for, the death of a soldier fighting for the rights of man." Great men. Story number 4, the miraculous capture of Fort Ticonderoga. Not many people are aware that the miraculous capture of Fort Ticonderoga resulted from a single punch to the face. So after the British fought in Lexington and Concord, they withdrew to Boston, where they hunkered down. They sealed off the city, prevented imports, exports, and trade. Benedict Arnold, one of the leading Sons of Liberty, was convinced that Washington needed cannons that they could put on Dorchester Heights so that they could get the British out of Boston, but the only available cannons were the British cannons at Fort Ticonderoga. So, and Fort Ticonderoga is on Lake Champlain, and it kind of divides Canada and New England from the southern colonies. So he got the Massachusetts leaders to agree to order him to lead a capture of the fort. So at the same time, Ethan Allen and his rough and ready mountain boys in Vermont decided that they need to attack Fort Ticonderoga and seize the cannons. Now you need to understand that the Green Mountain Boys are more like the Hell's Angels than a disciplined militia. They could have been called the Boy Mountains rather than the Mountain Boys. So as they were preparing their attack on Fort Ticonderoga, Benedict Arnold shows up and tells them that he's in charge of the attack, and he has official orders. They refuse, said, "We're not going to fight for you. We don't care if you're a general. We're going to fight for Ethan Allen." But they allowed him to tag along. So they, in the rainy night, they stole a bunch of boats, paddled across Lake Champlain. 200 of them gathered at the stone base of the fort. Burly Ethan Allen kicked the door into the fort, the locked door, ran up the stairs, came face to face with a sentry. The sentry pointed his rifle at Ethan Allen, pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. Because of the rain, the powder was wet. Ethan Allen immediately punched him in the face and knocked him unconscious. They raced over to the commander's quarters, started banging on the door. The commander came out in his underwear, all disheveled, and said, "What's this ruckus?" and saw Ethan Allen and the Mountain Boys. He had not been notified that we were at war. So he only had one sentry guarding the whole fort, and he was forced to surrender Ticonderoga because of one punch. So that's the miracle of Fort Ticonderoga. Well, in Boston, General Henry Knox, after whom Fort Knox is named, said, "We've got to bring those 61-ton cannons 300 miles to Boston," and he said, "I will do it." Washington didn't believe it could be done, but he let General Knox do it. So they had to go over the frozen, muddy ground, frozen rivers, and so it's called the Knox Expedition, or the Noble Train of Artillery. They averaged 3 miles a day, and in 90 days they reached Boston with the 61-ton cannons. So Washington gave General Knox the honor of placing the cannons on Dorchester Heights. When General Howe saw that his troops and his ships were in cannon range, they left Boston. Story number 5, Benedict Arnold, the great American hero. So some of you are smirking. When you hear the name Benedict Arnold, you think of one word, a traitor. That's true, but that's only half the story. After George Washington appointed General Benedict Arnold as commander of the strategic fort at West Point, that could split the colonies as well at West Point, he became embittered. He felt he was not getting the recognition and promotions and financial rewards that he deserved. His wife was a British loyalist, so she kept fanning these flames, and finally he decided to switch sides. So he sent his wife to New York City to meet with Major and Adjutant General John Andre, the head of British intelligence. And so General Andre traveled up the Hudson River and met with Benedict Arnold at West Point. Benedict Arnold agreed to surrender the fort to the British, and that would have split the colonies and probably would have cost us the war. He gave Spymaster Andre a letter with the terms. He listed the strategic information, the fort, the troop concentrations, the ammunition storage, the cannon emplacements, and in return for his betrayal, Arnold wanted a high command in the British Army and 20,000 English pounds. That's the equivalent of $4 million in today's money. So Andre agreed. Benedict Arnold put Andre in civilian clothes and gave him a false passport, and he headed out toward New York City. He was stopped by two highway robbers. These two highway robbers were deserters from George Washington's army. They searched him for booty, and they found in his stocking the plans and the of Fort West Point. Andre tried to talk them out of doing anything. That didn't work, so he tried to bribe them. So here are two highwaymen deserters, and they refused the bribe and did the right thing and turned Andre over to Washington's troops. So the plot was foiled. Benedict Arnold was able to go down in a small boat down the Hudson River to the British ship, the Vulture. He ended up being a major general in the British Army and leading the Brits against the Americans. He retired in London. But when Adjutant General Andre was arrested, as I mentioned, the British assumed nothing would happen to him, but Washington ordered him hung in revenge for the hanging of Nathan Hale. And after the war, the British exhumed the body of General Arnold and they buried him in Winchester Abbey with the British greatest men and women. So had the West Point been surrendered, it would have cut the colonies in half and we would have lost the war. Well, no one knows the other half of the story, that Benedict Arnold was a great American hero. He was a committed patriot. He's one of the original members of the Sons of Liberty. When the British imposed restrictions on Boston, he headed a ring of black marketing smugglers. He fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill in 1775. During the battle, his friend, Dr. Joseph Warren, was shot and killed, leaving two children orphaned. Benedict Arnold scraped up $500, which was a lot of money at that time, to give for the children's survival. And Benedict Arnold forced the government to give them a major general's allowance for life. So proving himself time and time again, he was promoted to general in the Continental Army. He had not only participated in the capture of Fort Ticonderoga, he broke the siege of Fort Stanwyck. He won the Battle of Valcour Island on Lake Champlain. He won the Battle of Ridgefield in Connecticut. But his greatest victory was the famous Battle of Saratoga in 1777. This was perhaps the most important and pivotal battle of the war. Once again, the British strategy was to cut the colonies in half in New York to separate New England from the southern colonies. And so they had a battle, they geared up for battle in Saratoga. After the first skirmish, General Arnold got in a loud shouting match with his commander, General Gates, over strategy. General Gates wanted to hunker down and go on the defense. General Benedict Arnold wanted to go on the offense and take the fight to the British. General Gates was so upset that he demoted General Arnold on the spot, relieved him of his field command, and put him under tent arrest. My house arrest, but you had to stay in your tent. So when the second battle started, General Arnold heard the shouts and screams of the American soldiers, realized that they were in trouble. He disobeyed his orders. He stormed out of the tent, got on his horse, saw the floundering Americans. He usurped command, took charge of the army over General Gates, routed the troops, and led them to victory over the British. Well, during the battle, he was shot through the leg. It went through his leg into the horse. The horse collapsed, crushing his leg. He ended up with a lot of pain. The left leg healed badly, so it was 2 inches shorter than his right leg. Because of his victory at Saratoga, British General Burgoyne surrendered and the colonies were still united. This became the turning point of the war. This was America's first significant victory against the British. Because of Saratoga, Ben Franklin was able to finally convince the King of France that we were a viable force against the British superpower, and so he agreed to send in Lafayette and 6,000 troops. So this was one of the most pivotal battles of the Civil War, and it's because of the heroism of Benedict Arnold. A large stone monument dedicated to Benedict Arnold and the victory at Saratoga was erected. There's a relief of a boot and leg in a stirrup, but there's no name on the monument. So after Saratoga, Congress rewarded General Arnold with restoring his rank. He was disabled, and while he healed, George Washington put him in charge of Fort West Point. Now the rest of the story. Benedict Arnold took the congressional action and George Washington's assignment as an insult. He chose to be offended. He interpreted their acts as acts of pity rather than promotion for heroism. He felt he should have been promoted, received more recognition and higher financial rewards, and so he became embittered, consumed with self-pity, and turned traitor, and the rest is history. So one of the most famous and important American heroes became our most famous traitor. Well, story number six, the founding enemies. You'll want to look at this as a supplement. We all assumed the founding fathers were peaceful friends getting along with an agreeable group. Nothing could be farther from the truth. These were intelligent, well-educated, outspoken men with big egos and strong opinions, and they disagreed on just about everything. And those disagreements were intense and they were heated. It's a miracle that these demigods, as Jefferson called them, could get together at one time and place and come up with a Constitution. A big part of the credit goes to humble, soft-spoken James Madison, who was a master at finding common ground and compromises. Well, but most people didn't realize that many of these founding fathers ended up as enemies. Thomas Paine, the father of the Revolution, became an enemy of George Washington, the father of the country. Patrick Henry, the great orator, became an enemy of James Madison, the father of the Constitution, Bill of Rights. Jefferson, for a time, became an enemy of John Adams. Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr became enemies, and Aaron Burr finally shot and killed Alexander Hamilton. Well, with reference to just Thomas Paine is the father of the American Revolution. In 1776, he published the two most influential pamphlets in history, Common Sense and the American Crisis. These inspired the Americans to declare war against Britain, and therefore he was given the name of the father of the Revolution. Common Sense was so popular at condemning British tyranny that they printed 500,000 copies, where the total population of the colonies was 2 million, men, women, and children. So 500,000 copies of that pamphlet. In the American Crisis, he wrote those famous words, "These are times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands now deserves the love and thanks of men and women. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheaply, we esteem too highly," or too lightly. Great words. So after the revolution, he goes to England and tries to start a revolution there. A warrant's issued for his arrest for treason. He wisely flees from England, goes to France, where he's considered a hero. He doesn't speak French. They immediately put him in the French Parliament. While he's in France, he starts publishing articles and books ridiculing organized religion, mocking Christianity, and degrading the Bible. So after publishing all of these, he starts criticizing the French government, and he ends up arrested. Well, American Ambassador James Monroe uses his personal connections to get Paine out of jail. Well, Paine was very upset that George Washington hadn't used his personal influence to prevent Thomas Paine's arrest, so he became an enemy of George Washington. He published articles openly accusing American's greatest hero of being an incompetent general. He accused him of being an elitist president. He accused him of being a fake and a fraud, and he accused Washington of being an egomaniac. For all the people who are not an egomaniac, it's certainly George Washington. Well, in 1802, after George Washington died, President Thomas Jefferson invited Thomas Paine to return to the United States. Having alienated all the Christians and having alienated all the fans of George Washington, Paine was virtually shunned, and he died in 1809 as a pauper. The funerals of most founding fathers were well attended. The beloved international celebrity Benjamin Franklin drew a record crowd of 20,000 people at his funeral. In contrast, the funeral of Thomas Paine, the father of the American Revolution, was attended by only 6 people, counting the gravediggers. No politicians came, no founding fathers came, there was no eulogy. He was buried in obscurity. Okay, so story number 8 or 7, universal geniuses. Few people know about universal geniuses. Universal genius is a super genius who has an almost universal grasp of human knowledge and mastery in many fields, and is estimated to have an IQ above 195. This includes Aristotle, Leonardo da Vinci, and Isaac Newton. To cut time short, there are only 2 Americans, only 30 universal geniuses in world history, 2 which were American, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, and amazingly, they both lived at the same time in a backward country, and they were brilliant. Okay, the 8th story, Jefferson. Jefferson was not always successful. There's a theoretical Jefferson versus the practical Jefferson. So he had a long-standing vision of organizing the world's first secular public university. On his tombstone are written his 3 greatest accomplishments, and he wrote these himself. Quote, author of the Declaration of Independence and the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. So he wanted to have a unique university. He knew that the students were intelligent, self-disciplined, and so he decided that they did not need an honor code. The students were trustworthy and could be respected and would respect others. Well, he was unaware of practical human nature, so the students proved that they were not masters of self-discipline. They started skipping classes and drinking, and one night, 14 of the drunken students put on masks. They beat one professor with a brick, they beat another with a cane. Upon hearing the news, Jefferson was overwhelmed with grief. In response, they asked Jefferson, now 82 years old and very frail, to speak to the students. In his remarks, Jefferson talked about the lofty principles upon which the university was founded, and he had expected more from the students. He said that this was the most painful experience of his entire life. He suddenly stopped speaking, his eyes welled up in tears. He was so overcome that he sat down and couldn't go on. The 14 students were so touched they immediately stood up, identified themselves, and confessed to their guilt, but the damage had been done. And the University of Virginia, as a practical matter, adopted a strict code of conduct and regulations to govern the conduct of the students. Well, 9th, the final story, is the contribution of the founding mothers. And so we have the famous founding mothers, Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, Dolly Madison, Betsy Ross, but there are others less famous. An estimated 4,000 women helped the Continental Army as camp followers. These were primarily wives and mothers who informally attached themselves to the loved ones' units. They nursed the sick and wounded, they cleaned laundry, they repaired uniforms, they knitted socks, sometimes they cooked, but most importantly, they kept their husbands and sons from deserting. So these women were motivated by love and patriotism. They were also motivated by desperation. So with their breadwinners in the army, they faced starvation. So they went through the same things as the men. You didn't know about the women in Valley Forge, you think of the men. But these camp followers were suffering through Valley Forge as well. The soldiers paid them a nominal fee for their services to provide for the laundry services, and they shared their meek rations with them. The women were exposed. Sometimes when they were alone, they were raped or murdered. The relationship between the women camp followers and the generals was mixed. The army needed them and they needed the army, but some commanders thought they were a distraction. And so George Washington wrote to his commanders, "I was obliged to give provisions to the extra women in these regiments, or lose by desertion, perhaps to the enemy, some of our oldest and best soldiers in the service." General Henry Knox wrote, "The number of women in the New York regiments obliged me to allow them provisions, or by driving them from the army, risk the loss of a number of men who probably would have followed their wives rather than the generals." So their contribution to the American Revolution is immeasurable. They helped the wounded at every major battle. Now, just a couple of the women. Sybil Ludington, age 16, she rode farther than Paul Revere in carrying message. In 1777, word came to her father, Colonel Ludington, that Danbury, Connecticut was under attack and needed help. The messenger was too fatigued to ride any further, so they needed someone to ride during the rain at night through the scattered farms. So Sybil Ludington, age 16, volunteered. She got on her horse, rode approximately 40 miles through the woods in the rain at night, and summoned several hundred militiamen to confront the British. Another woman, Mary Catherine Goddard, she was the first person to publish and distribute the copies of the Declaration of Independence, which helped inspire the nation. She did that when she served as postmaster. She replaced Ben Franklin as postmaster, probably the first woman in the colonies to hold government office. And there's Mary Corbin. She fought alongside her husband at the cannon, so she was helping him with the cannon. When her husband was killed, instead of going to pieces, she took over his role at the cannon. She was hit by cannon fire, grape shot, 3 times in the same arm. Left her crippled, she was captured. The British released her to the Philadelphia hospital. When she got out of the hospital, she helped the war effort again. She was given a half soldier's pension for the rest of her life and is the first woman in American history to receive a military pension and the only Revolutionary War veteran, man or woman, to be buried at West Point. Then there's Deborah Sampson. She was one of the documented women who disguised themselves as a man so they could fight in the Continental Army. She was 5'8", which was very large for a man at that time. She first enlisted under the name of Timothy Thayer. She collected the enlistment bounty, but someone snitched her off the next day, and she had to turn the money. So then she enlisted in the 4th Massachusetts Regiment as Robert Shurtleff. She fought for 17 months, was finally wounded, and was given an honorable discharge, and she was the second woman in American history to receive a military pension. She spent her later years recalling her war experiences to young women and promoting gender equality. And finally, one of my favorite little stories is Mary Hayes. Mary Hayes was married to an artilleryman, and during the battle, she would grab pitchers of water and bring them to help relieve the men. So she was running through all those cannon firing bullets, giving them water. They gave her the nickname of Molly Pitcher. But in the Battle of Monmouth in 1778, her husband was injured. She immediately took his place at the cannon. During the fight, a cannonball went between her legs, tore off her dress. She looked down and shrugged and said, "Well, that could have been worse," and immediately reloaded the cannon. Incredible. What great stories. Well, in conclusion, Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, taught, "The Lord established the constitution of this hand, of this land, by the hand of wise women, men and women, I add, whom he raised up for this very purpose and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. The founding fathers and mothers were convinced that this nation was established by the hand of divine providence." And the more you learn about the inspiring stories and miracles surrounding the birth of this nation, the more you will become convinced of the hand of divine providence in founding this great nation. Amen. Thank you.